Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hello all, and welcome to this, our 50th edition of Risky Business, the podcast endorsed by the Australian Information Security Association. 50 episodes already. My God, time really goes by quickly. I swear I'll just blink one day and I'll be sucking down applesauce through a straw into my toothless, confused head in some old folks' home somewhere. It really goes quickly, doesn't it? Anyway, this week's show is brought to you by the fine folks at Symantec, the big yellow box, as I like to call them. Rogan Mallon, a senior systems engineer with the company's New Zealand division, will be along soon to discuss inadvertent internal threats to your data in this week's sponsor interview. Apparently they haven't invented Norton Anti-Stupid yet, but they're working on it. This week's feature interview is a little bit different to what you're used to. We're chatting with Les Goldsmith. He runs a Cairns-based technical surveillance countermeasures business, ESD Group. Now, TSCM is mostly about bug hunting. And as Goldsmith points out, you might not just be paranoid. People who suspect they're being bugged turn out to be right about 10% of the time. You might have heard us talk about ESD Group last week in the news. They also do encrypted telephony. But anyway, Les will be along shortly to chat with us. But first, as always, it's time for this week's news with Munir Kataria. Now, Munir, in this first item, it looks like a media advisor from the Bulldogs NRL, for our foreign listeners, that's the National Rugby League.
Egg chasers.
I've not heard that one. That's brilliant. From the Bulldogs Egg Chasers team, had actually been sending around emails from his home computer designed to look like they were from someone else, and he got caught.
Very, very naughty and very, very stupid for getting caught.
Well, yeah, because he didn't even use a Gmail account or anything. He just set up like a mail account on his home computer, and he was probably using Outlook or something, and sent around all this defamatory stuff to all of the board members of this sports club, and it's blown up, and it's a huge scandal.
Can you imagine when he was doing it? It's so funny. He must have thought he was so clever.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, check this out. I'm going to do this. Nobody's going to know.
You can forge emails, and no one will ever know. On the internet, no one can hear you scream.
True. But no, he got done and too right.
So this media advisor was saying that one of these directors of the Bulldogs, Ray Dibb, was linked to an ICAC inquiry, and that's the Independent Commission Against Corruption. So, you know, he made some pretty heavy allegations in these anonymous emails, and then, you know, really they called Forensic Data Services, who would have gone, he left his IP in the header. Voila, there you go. So I think he's stepped down and... looks like he's being sued for defamation as well. So
that's right. For sending a false and slanderous email.
That's right. Good luck. Courtroom. Now, this item, not strictly a security story, but definitely of sufficient interest, I think, to run in risky business. The Rudd government reckons the $85 million software filter scheme to protect Australians from online pornography is a dud.
Oh, God. Well, thank God somebody's come out and said that. I mean, we've been saying it's rubbish from the start. It's a stupid idea as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but that's because we're always right. I mean,
well, yes, we are. And here we go again. Right once more. It seems that only 2% of the target was achieved. It's like 29,000 people have access to filter products.
Yeah. So basically, the government decided that, you know, internet pornography was probably, you know, the most threatening thing to our society. So they created this scheme whereby concerned parents could grab a free filter.
Yeah.
And they were expecting 2.5 million households will install it, but after 12 months...
Yeah, only 144,000 actually installed it, and they reckon only just under 30,000 of them are actually still using it.
Sorry, it hasn't been 12 months. It's been since August, but yeah 144,000 downloads. It's free, and people still don't want it.
Yeah, well...
I think mum and dad might not want to install the porno filters because then they won't get their porn.
And the other thing is, I mean, come on, within a week of this thing coming out, there was, what, a 14-year-old kid that managed to get by it?
Yeah. And then he wound up writing most of the ALP's IT policy. What's really funny, though, is he's a smart kid.
Oh, yeah,
he had some great ideas, you know.
Totally was. And then they hired him, help them fix it.
Okay, moving on. We'll just quickly mention this. For those Mac users out there, you're about to get whole disk encryption.
Yeah, that's right. PGP is working on it. They haven't said exactly when they're going to do it, but Intel-based Macs on OS X will soon be able to encrypt their entire disks.
Yay!
Yeah, about time. There's been some issues with that, hasn't there? There's never been like a full disk encryption thing for the Macs.
No, there hasn't. But I guess full disk encryption was never really that popular until more recently. So,
yeah,
you know, big deal. But yeah, so there you go. Full disk encryption. It's third party. I'm kind of surprised they didn't bring out full disk encryption in Leopard, actually.
Yeah, that is a bit of a surprise.
To compete, but, you know, because they're always slagging off Microsoft for copying them. And it's like, well, you don't have full disk encryption. Vista does.
It's true.
Put that in your bloody skivvy and smoke it. Anyway.
Okay. Moving on.
A Brisbane mother of two has been jailed for operating bank accounts linked to phishing.
This is interesting. I'm surprised we don't see more of these stories coming out. Yeah, this is like a fishing mule. You know, we've all seen the stupid adverts out there. Yes, do you want a part-time job? You can earn thousands of dollars a week, and all you have to do is have a few bank accounts and fiddle some money around.
Well, it's really quite clever the way that they do this. I mean, they sucker, you know, gullible people in with these spam emails saying, you know, you can earn money by transferring money around. They, you know, collect a whole bunch of login credentials for bank accounts. Then they transfer all of that money into that account. Which is a Patsy account, of course, because they can't do direct transfers overseas. Then they instruct that person that their job is then to withdraw the money from that account and wire it via Western Union to, like, Kazakhstan or Uzbekistan or something.
One of those stans, yes.
Yeah, phishing stan. she pleaded guilty to dealing in proceeds of crime worth $10,000 or more and using telecommunications network with intent to commit a serious offence.
Yeah, the really sad thing about this is that her husband got done for the same thing a little while ago.
Poor kids.
Yeah, that's right. So they're both into it. They're both seeming like they had really great part-time jobs and fiddling all this money around, and now they're both in a little bit of trouble.
Yeah, and meanwhile, the guys who made the real money out of this are sitting, you know, off somewhere smoking cigars and laughing about their plight because they're evil.
Right. Apparently, it seems that she received about 56 grand into her account, 37,000 of which has never been found, and now she's been ordered to pay back all the money.
Yeah, it's not real cool, is it?
No, it's not.
But it's, you know, it is a strong deterrent, and, you know, you got to wonder how much of an excuse gullibility is in these sort of cases, you know?
It seems like it's no excuse at all.
Well, yeah, apparently not. 8 months in prison and a $50,000 reparations bill. Yeah, oops.
Yep.
Okay. Now, when was that? It was about a year ago. There was the story that came out that Ausert was not going to continue its cybercrime survey because the Australian Institute of Criminology was going to do a much, much bigger one.
Yeah, that's right. It seems like they're still going to do one. But
well, I think they've just started, haven't they? And they're going to survey 10,000 businesses across the country seeking information about their experiences with online transgressions and what is being done to prevent them.
Yeah, and it seems we couldn't find out exactly when they'll come out, but I assume it'll be around Ausert time, which is May, right?
Yeah. It's usually, I mean, it's been May every year, so yeah. I presume it's May again this year. But
yep.
It's just interesting, isn't it? Because we didn't really have a cybercrime survey last year. I think the Ausert one had sort of reached its use-by date, you know? It was just a bit small, and this aims to be a much bigger one. But what I'm really going to be interested in seeing is the questions that they're using.
Yeah, that's right. One of the other issues with this is that, you know, when they do one survey, it's fair enough, but then it's the year after where you can actually see the trends and see where it's going. And that was the great thing about the Ausert survey for a few years there. But then they changed all the questioning, so, you know, making the comparisons was pretty useless for a while.
Well,
now, again, I don't quite know what we're going to get from this survey, but I'm more looking forward to the one next year rather than the one that's going to come out this year.
Well, the one that was launched in the earlier Ausert surveys,
yep.
Deloitte Consulting actually had a big input into the questions, and
yep.
Some of them were just really kind of misleading.
Okay.
Like they classed, you know, a virus even knocking on your firewall as a hack attempt.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, anyone who's actually sat around and looked at logs realizes that, like, Code Red is still out there knocking on your firewall, you know, 50 times a day. So, you know, according to that survey, you know, 90 people had been attacked by hackers.
Yeah.
No, I mean, I'm sorry, 90% of people had been attacked by hackers, when really, anyone who knows anything about, you know, security knows that if that's your definition, it would have been 100%. So
yeah, totally. Yeah.
The early editions had no credibility. I mean, that's why I'm going to be interested to see if they've actually managed to come up with clear questions that are going to give us meaningful information.
Well, I guess there's one we're definitely going to be looking out for.
Okay. Another quick item. There have been multiple flaws reported in the Linux kernel.
In what?
I know, but you know, everybody knows Linux is perfect.
It is perfect. No, they can't be. They must have got this wrong.
Especially the kernel, because the kernel was maintained by Linus Torvalds, who is the...
Linus.
he's the saviour.
He is, totally.
He's the greatest human being on the planet. I mean, he'd trademark that, but he doesn't believe in intellectual property like that.
Oh, dear. Well, seems like he makes mistakes.
Yeah, well, apparently. So the flaws, as reported by Linux vulnerability researcher Jens Axboe.
That's a great name.
It is, isn't it? A-X-B-O-E. Yeah. Affect versions of Ubuntu, SUSE, however you want to say it. Me say SUSE, you say SUSE.
I think it's SUSE.
Suzy. Okay, Suzy Linux, all right. Red Hat, Mandrake, Debian, and, you know, blah, 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 blah. So, yeah. It's a memory access vulnerability rated as high in severity. Not real cool. It's a VM Splice system call. So, if you haven't heard about this, go forth and patch now. Now, I really don't like Second Life stories, but this one's kind of funny. Munir, you want to walk us through it?
So it's the QuickTime Evil Pink Box flaw, basically. And what the researchers have done is they've used the flaw in QuickTime to basically steal money from innocent Second Life victims.
Now, it's really cool, too, the way they do it. They had an avatar holding up a sign saying, "Welcome to ShmooCon." And, like, anyone who went up and, like, got close to this guy would have their entire bank account, their virtual bank account, just drain.
It's amazing how they can do that, huh?
Yeah, I think it's a really cool little attack, and it's just very, 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 very clever. And $275 Linden apparently work out to a dollar in the real world. I don't know if that's US dollars or Australian dollars. It's not specified in the piece, but there is a bit of a financial incentive there for these sort of attacks. And really, the way that it works, it's a flaw in QuickTime. So anyone who comes close enough to your evil pink box, it sort of renders in QuickTime, triggers a code execution, which then grabs your bank account and, transfers it all to the attacker. But
It's a very, very clever trick.
I think, you and me should consider going evil and just steal money from people in Second Life. Because
I like the thought of that.
I don't know. It's kind of... Just think, if you've got a big bank balance in Second Life, you kind of deserve to have it stolen.
I guess so.
We could give it to the poor.
The poor people on Second Life?
No, just the poor people in the real world. Like, we trash all of their bank accounts, we turn it into real money, and then we give it, we dig wells in Africa.
We can be Robin Hood. Oh, that would be even cooler. Yeah.
All right, mate. Well, I think that's basically it for this week.
It is indeed, yes.
All right. Well, thanks again. And as always, we'll chat again next week.
Cheers, mate. Look forward to it.
Thanks for that, Munir. This week's feature interview is indeed about information security, but about a type of threat that we don't normally think of: listening devices and illegal telephone intercepts. Quite often, an attacker doesn't want what's in your database. They want to know what your CEO is saying about a particular deal when he's in the office and thinks no one's listening. Believe it or not, corporate espionage is indeed a reality in Australia, usually in big dollar industries. And not surprisingly, it's a big problem for government as well. To combat these sorts of bugging issues, victims of these practices need a special kind of pest controller, one who uses sophisticated equipment to detect and eradicate these nasty little devices. And that's where TSCM companies, and that stands for Technical Surveillance Countermeasures, can help. Les Goldsmith runs ESD Group, a TSCM and encrypted telephony company based in Cairns, and he spoke to me last week. I started by asking him what types of organisations hire him to perform bug sweeps in the first place.
Well, those sort of services, of course, are usually people which are involved in larger markets, or in a very competitive market. Ranges from everything from hair product manufacturers and distributors through to governments and financial institutions.
Okay, just see if listeners can spot the odd one out there. Hair products?
Yeah. Well, that's the oddest one we've had. It's actually is a hair products manufacturer.
And did you find anything?
They were being monitored, yes.
They were being monitored. Okay, so obviously there is, to an extent, a problem. I believe in a previous interview you told me that one time in 10 when you're called to do a bug sweep of a particular company, you actually find something. Is that right?
That's correct, yes. It is 1 out of 10.
So who's running around putting these bugs in to all of these Australian organisations?
Okay, well, in most cases, it's someone that has access already to the installation, or it can also be someone that is delivering, say, a gift or otherwise. So you might give someone a plaque put on the wall, and the plaque might be bugged, or you might replace the handset on the desk with a telephone handset that is bugged. It's as simple as that. The example would be a cleaner needs some extra money. they're a bit down on their luck and someone offers them $100 to replace a telephone sitting on someone's desk.
Yeah, but I mean, obviously this stuff is illegal. So, I mean, do you find it surprising that organisations are prepared to run the risk of being caught doing this stuff?
I think it's more so the matter that they think that there's some enmity. If they buy the device and have someone else install it, and if they do it without exchanging names, they think they're not going to get caught. Or in the other circumstance, they say, I didn't realise there was anything wrong with the telephone. There's nothing for them to really be linked to it without physically having fingerprints on the phone or having the phone diverted to them.
So, in other words, it's really hard to get caught. So,
if they can get caught than more traditional espionage methods.
Now, usually when someone gets you on the phone and says, hey, we think we've got a problem here, what sort of job role is that person in? Does it usually come from the board, management, or does it come from people who work in information security or people who work in physical security?
Okay, well, it's kind of a divided group here. Depending on the size of the company, if it's a very huge company, then usually it would be IT security. If it's a government, it would usually be the protocol office for that particular government's parliament that would make that initial contact, or an intelligence agency. If it's a smaller company, it would usually be chief financial officer or chief information officer or the managing director of the company.
This is obviously enough of a problem for you to have something like 20 employees in a few different countries?
That's correct, yes. The problem exists. However, often most people don't realise it's going on because there isn't no formal reporting method for people to bring this sort of information forward. And quite frankly, most companies wouldn't want you to know that they had been bugged.
It's the same with data breaches, as we've found, which is why there's a lot of debate around data breach disclosure laws here in Australia. Now, one of the things making your life a little bit easier than that of your US counterparts, Les, is I understand it's illegal in the United States for a private citizen to own a listening device, so making it very hard for people training in your particular art or science to learn, whereas here that's not such a problem.
That's correct. You can certainly do training courses within the United States, which are of, you know, fantastic benefit. And ourselves, we have all done training courses within the United States. However, the availability of legal surveillance devices in the United States is only limited to government agencies. So the corporate trainers have to use improvised devices in order to train people in the art. As a result, in Australia, we have the advantage of being able to import any surveillance devices we like and use those in training. So, yes, our staff do get the benefit from the full range of devices, which, for example, for our US-based staff means they can travel out here. They can do training with the more sophisticated surveillance devices and then take that training back with them to the United States.
But I guess also the problem is, I guess because we do have surveillance devices available here, it means that the bad guys can get a hold of them more easily, doesn't it?
That's absolutely correct, and that's a serious problem. We have so many spy shops that are within Australia and operating online, which allow you to buy UHF and VHF surveillance devices readily over the internet or over the phone. As an example, you can buy a UHF device that has a kilometre range for a few hundred dollars in Australia, and that will be shipped direct to you. And there are no questions asked about how you're going to use the device. It's simply sold, and it's in your responsibility to abide by the law.
Well, that begs the question, who is actually putting these bugs in place illegally? I believe in the United States, it's private investigators who are a bit on the shonky side engage in this sort of stuff. But who is it here doing it?
Okay, well, you're absolutely right. In the United States, it is more typically in the obvious sense, the media highlights the private investigators as being the major offenders. In Australia, though, you find that a number of company executives, being how much they don't want information leaked, are probably more likely to have someone closer to home to install it or to find someone they can pay, of which is not going to talk.
Between the availability of the equipment online and the simplicity of having the device put in there, you don't really need an intermediary or an expert, do you?
No. Or the other option would simply be to make an appointment with the individual that you want to see or that you want to listen to within the office. Find a way to get into their office, whether it be an appointment or otherwise. Wander in there, sit down with them, ask for a drink. When you ask for a drink, spill the drink. They're liable to get up and get someone else to clean the drink up or otherwise, or to get you a towel. In doing so, you have an opportunity to plant the device. It's really not that difficult in order to get a device in. It depends on how sophisticated the device is and how well you want to conceal it. An example might be if you want to put a device into a table, then you might want a fair amount of time because you might want to take a leg off and bore it out a bit and then put the device in. Or you might want to drill a hole in the top of a door, insert the device into there and then recap the door. There are a number of different things. You might want to hide it within a lounge and you might want to tear open the seam to do that. That way if someone picks up a cushion and thinks, no, there's nothing under there, puts it back and moves on. So there's a number of different ways of concealing the devices. It's just a matter of how much time you have to do it.
Thanks for the tip.
Not a problem.
In previous discussions we've had, Les, you've told me that you can actually have a bit of fun with people who've put bugs in by moving them to another room.
That's correct, yes. One of the advantages we have is that if we passively detect the device, we can move it to another location. So in some instances, what we'll do is create a secure room, put a couple of lounges in there and a little coffee table so you can have a drink. And what we'll do is put the device into that room and the room will be marked as the bugged room so that company executives and so forth want to provide misinformation to a competitor or to another government, depending on who is being bugged, can then wander into that particular room and discuss any sort of false information they wish to mislead someone with.
So, Les, can you think of any funny examples of where people have, sent some particularly misleading stuff down the wire?
Oh, certainly. An example would be when we've had a foreign country being visited by a representative from another country, and we've had an embassy where we've actually used that embassy to stage the arrival time and location of the individual. And the individual had already been on the ground for a day. However, a number of individuals had gone to the airport waiting for this person to arrive. And yes, of course, they were already here. So that was fairly pointless.
Yeah, I can imagine it would have been. And it would have also enabled various authorities to identify who they were and perhaps keep an eye on them.
That's the one advantage we have. It's with counterintelligence, if you can gather the information on who is monitoring you or what method they're using to monitor you, counterintelligence is all about providing misinformation and blocking relevant information.
I imagine, with most bugs, you'd need someone within the local range sitting in a van, with a tape recorder. Is that right?
No, there's a number of ways of doing it. The more common way is that at the moment is to use UHF transmitters, particularly burst transmitters, where you're actually recording information, holding it in memory, and then bursting it out in a number of milliseconds.
Okay.
Which makes it extremely difficult for handheld bug detecting type people to locate. And with that sort of device, they might go ahead and put that device in, and it might then store an amount of data, transmit that data, and all you'd need to do is have a receiver nearby that is voice activated. So you don't have to sit there and monitor it. You can come back each week and obtain the data from it. Alternatively, you can actually send it over IP. So you could actually transmit it to another location with a receiver and then have that receiver then put it onto the IP and send it across the net. So you wouldn't actually have to be nearby. The other alternative, of course, is we're getting a fair few of now is using GSM. Hmm. Where they'll actually have a microphone, for example, rigged up within a building and a silenced GSM mobile phone attached to it. And what you do is you would dial into that mobile phone to obtain audio. So you would be obtaining audio from anywhere in the world with GSM that you could listen to from wherever you like.
Just got to ask, I mean, with something like a UHF burst detector, a burst transmitter, how would you go about detecting something like that? That would be very hard.
It is, yes. Well, it is traditionally. That's the one advantage we have. It's with the equipment that we use, and most of our equipment is US manufactured. A burst transmitter is essentially something that is transmitting on intervals, and if you can monitor those intervals and record what we call the RF mapping survey, you can detect where your signal strength is strongest, and we can isolate the area within a building or within a room that the transmitter is. And it takes a while, but you eventually get to the point where you're cornering the transmitter.
Now, in addition to bugging, what are some other common intelligence gathering techniques that are used on corporate Australia and government departments, for that matter, illegally?
Okay. Well, one of the other more common ones would actually be the use of infrared microphones. Okay. So you actually bouncing a laser off glass, gathering vibration from the glass and obtaining audio back from it.
So what, get heavy curtains?
Curtains are good, but also just having thicker glass to start with. And if you're in a noisy environment, it really isn't that much of a risk. A lot of media hype has been around the use of lasers and lasers obtaining audio from rooms, but I'll give you an example. If I was to go into an area and observe a building at night, and I might go to a building opposite and I need to monitor the fifth floor, I get onto an equal floor, hook up my laser, point it directly at the glass, have the laser bounce back, use my receiver, gather the information from the laser and convert it back to audio. Now, I might have crystal clear audio when I do this at 11 o'clock at night. However, when I come back to actually do the monitoring, when the meeting's on at 10 a.m.
And there's trucks driving past in the
exactly,
street?
Exactly. There is vibration on the outside of the glass more than there is on the inside.
Mm.
Hence, on the outside, there is a lot more background noise. So it almost makes it useless in order to obtain audio.
Now, the other aspect to your business, Les, is encrypted telephony. And you guys are resellers for a German company called GSMK Cryptophone. Is that right?
That is correct, yes. About 2 years ago, GSMK Cryptophone approached us, knowing our reputation in the region, and offered us the distribution rights for Australia and New Zealand and Papua New Guinea at the time. And we looked at the product quite seriously then, purchased some, used them within our own operations and demonstrated them to clients and found them to be quite useful. So that we took on the distribution of the product.
Now, for listeners who don't know what these products do, you can get them on a smartphone, and they use the sort of data part of the GSM standard to communicate with another smartphone with the same software loaded on it. That's for your GSM type of connections. And you can do really James Bond stuff with these too, like do manual hash confirmation. So, you know, a hash will pop up on each user's screen and they read it to each other. And it's, you've also got your VoIP products, your PSTN products. And now this is the one you've just launched, is these satellite products. Can you tell us a bit about them?
Yes. Okay. Well, getting back first of all to GSM, there is the GSM Smart Flip, which is the G10i model, which is a smart flip quad band phone. And of course, yes, it uses circuit switch data in order to pass the encrypted telephone call across. Essentially, what the user has is they have a GSM phone number and they have a data phone number. If you wish to call the person securely, you simply go into the crypto application on the phone and dial the secure number for the other person. And then, of course, it'll connect the data channel and you'll have an encrypted call across there. The PSTN phone does a similar thing in that what it does is on the PSTN network, you pick up your normal telephone, desktop phone that is connected to the encryption unit. You dial the number of the other person's encrypted telephone line, and then you can connect the call over circuit switch data. And the VoIP unit, yes, that works as well with a VoIP adapter. You plug the VoIP adapter in as long as you have quality of service and you can verify the quality of the line and the continued quality of the line, then you can use our products also on VoIP. The satellite phone that you mentioned, yes, we now have Thuraya 3 launched, which is the third satellite for Thuraya, which gives coverage right across the Asia Pacific. As an example, it goes as far south as Tasmania and as far north as just north of Japan. So for ESD Australia, we have approximately 21 countries we represent at the moment for GSMK. That gives us an excellent coverage.
Okay, well, Les Goldsmith, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
ESD Group's Les Goldsmith on the line from Cairns there. And incidentally, after we spoke, Les said that 1 in 10 people who contact him, he winds up finding a listening device there, but they only wind up doing about 3 actual bug sweeps for every 10 people that contact them. So there you go. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. Without our sponsors, we would not be able to produce this show for, my God, 50 episodes now. So really, the least we can do is offer them some airtime. This week's show is brought to you by Symantec. So we got the company's senior systems engineer, Rogan Mallon from New Zealand, on the line from the land of the long white cloud to talk about insider threats. As you'll hear, they come from the unlikeliest of sources and are often accidental. But until someone invents a new kind of IDS, an incompetence detection system, we'll have to rely on good old-fashioned best practice to avert disasters, Mallon says.
If you've got someone who's specifically motivated to disrupt your business internally, or steal information, or you know, if that's specifically what they're trying to do, then you're right. It becomes quite a difficult task. You really want to be identifying those people through other processes rather than relying on trying to protect or make your infrastructure completely bulletproof.
So this is more like the bank's approach, which is audit the absolute crap out of absolutely everything, and you'll start to see discrepancies instead of relying on technical measures.
That's right. So that also comes down to the nature of the threats, of course. So because what we're talking about here is not just the deliberately malicious attacks, which, although they happen, probably not... don't contribute as much to the overall problem as we may think. So, for instance, in our recent IT risk management report that we conducted jointly with MIT's Center for Information Research, we found that the majority, which turned out to be 53% of IT incidents, have an internal process-based cause. So these are often down to misconfigurations, people with incorrect access rights or usage, people applying patches or making modifications to servers and software and the like, which all lead to incidents that will affect the business overall, but are not necessarily malicious activities.
So in that case, you'd need an IDS, but that, of course, standing for Incompetency Detection System.
So we haven't quite devised the software to detect those incompetent moments. You're right, but it raises a good point. If we've got the IDS in place, that's fine for picking up those deliberately malicious network-borne threats at our assets. But if we've got an overzealous administrator, I was involved with an example here in New Zealand. It was a 2000.
Sorry, I just had a really funny mental image of an overzealous systems administrator just running around patching boxes and just, you know, being really enthusiastic.
Yeah, well,
mental image.
I've got a specific example of that, actually. A 2000 user site here. It was a junior network administrator person that had been to a Microsoft security course on securing IIS, and they literally left that course in the afternoon, went back to their workplace, applied these lockdown policies to IIS and locked all 2,000 users out of the using the internet at that organisation.
Nice.
So there's a real world example. Their intentions were good. In fact, they thought they'd learnt so much from that day that they felt that they were in the best position to go and implement this back at their organisation. Mm. The problem they had there was they didn't have the processes in place. He had the administrative rights to do what he was able to do, but there was no process in place that said anything here needs to go through these specific levels of change control. You need to submit your proposed changes, reasons for them. You need to schedule the time to do it and all those things. So a lot of organisations have those processes in place. Mm. But then we still have organisations who are simply relying on, so that IIS server, for instance, could have the best intrusion detection software in the world, but if the administrator is able to bypass it through their own rights to that machine, then it all becomes null and void when they make a misconfiguration. But it still has the same end result. If it was a hacker attacking that IIS server and was able to bring it down cause a denial of service for them, it was the same as the administrator themselves misconfiguring the server, causing a denial of service, and then they're unable to conduct normal daily business.
So generally speaking, what you're saying is the biggest insider threat is that some klutz is going to do something stupid. Then what can a company like Symantec actually do to, or you know, anyone, CA or whoever, what can a software vendor then do to stop those sort of things from happening?
Right. So it's, and I guess that's the part of the overall picture here that we're trying to convey. It's not simply down to a software package. There's no Norton anti-stupid.
I like it.
We can't we can't just put anything in place that's necessarily going to stop all these things. So the point we're trying to make here, I guess, is that these organizations need to be aware that it's about so much more than just the technology itself. It's down to the processes and the people as well. Mm. And if they're going to stay on top of these things, they need to have a much more well-rounded IT risk management process in place. So they're looking at everything. So in those instances, again, to stop that employee misuse, having the process in place that says this is how you go about making a system change. It's certainly a dry topic. It's boring. It involves all the documentation and process, and people aren't so keen on that. But it's really the way forward if you are going to try and minimise these particular risks to your organisation.
Do you think it comes down to that whole old argument of, you know, 9/10 of security is just doing stuff properly?
You did right. If we can just follow a structured process, the entire IT industry is built on a foundation of logic. So,
Do you really think that? I think it's like what's that tarot card? You know, the Tower. You know, I've got hippie friends. I've seen tarot cards. Leave me alone,
right? The tower, yeah.
But yeah, there's the Tower, and it's just like this higgledy-piggledy thing that just looks like it's about to collapse at any second. I mean, every time I see that thing, I think of the IT industry because it's, you know, if it was built on logic by engineers all in white lab coats with pocket protectors, you know, we wouldn't have the problems that we have now, do we? I mean, don't you think a lot of the process that we need to secure things is about controlling the uncontrollable elements of IT, vulnerabilities and instability and all of that sort of crap.
Yeah, it's a difficult one to pinpoint. I guess if I knew the magic bullet answer, we'd be stopping it left, right, and centre. But I guess the point I was trying to make, being built on logic, is things are all about ones and zeros, yes or no. Algorithms do this, and this will happen. It's when you add that human element, as you mentioned, that tower does become so much more higgledy-piggledy. And that we've got the human emotional issues that surround it. You know, should I do this now? You know, can I go ahead and do this? Surely if I do this, then there's a way to back out of it afterwards. But if they haven't just followed a step-by-step procedure that says, here's exactly what you do and how you do it, and here's your back-out procedure should something go wrong. And we still see a lot of organizations that don't have those basic levels of control in there. The organisations, it showed through in our risk management report that the organisations who had a much more balanced process across all these areas were much less susceptible to IT risks. Organisations that relied heavily on technology to solve their issues were still having incidents that they weren't in a position to be able to combat or deal with.
Mm.
So we've got the report talks about 5 steps for executing effective IT risk management programs. So first of all is awareness of your environment and of the threats that may affect your business continuity. Being able to quantify the business impacts is something that a lot of people still struggle with. If this particular server goes down, what is the end result in dollar value to our business? How long can we afford it to be down for? Must the system be configured in a automatic failover, high availability configuration, or is it acceptable to our business that if something goes wrong with the server, that it takes us 8 hours, 24 hours, 2 days to restore the system? It is a lot of work up front, but as the old saying goes, fail to prepare and you'll need to prepare to fail.
Oh, there we go. Sagely, mate. Very sagely. Okay, Rogan, look, that's all we're going to have time for, mate, but thank you very much for joining us this week on Risky Business.
No worries. You're welcome. Thanks, Patrick.
Rogan Mallon there from Symantec New Zealand. And thanks again to Symantec for making this week's episode of Risky Business possible. And that's it for this week's show. I hope you've enjoyed it. This week's music to take us out is from Aussie band Marshall and the Fro, and the song's called Something Better. And they're playing this Friday at the Blue Tile Lounge in Fitzroy if you're based in Melbourne. Check them out. It's always a fun show. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Read those clouds, make no sense at all. Touch the sky with another man's call. Dance in the desert, but dance in the street. The music shows in your feet. Kids in thongs and peers in chong. People who talk and all get along. I felt you before, but I'm not so sure. I can't look back, said I'm always looking forward. You can bank your money till the cows come home, or free some mates from the bills they owe. It's just a setback, it's not the end. Keep on pushing, but you got great friends.
Striving for something better, striving for something better, striving for something better. Gonna come from this, I know. Striving for something better, striving for something better, striving for something better. Gonna come from this, I know.
Here we try from what is left. We're not a matter for your second guess. We can make you grin. How's that a sin? Don't squint your eyes from the glare, my friend. I know what I want, only after I don't. Like those times when we used to smoke. I think to myself that I should be safe, but then I turn to her and say it wasn't me.
Sorry for something better.